Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. I saw this story about dogs hunting rats, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to talk to Megan Renner, who is both a certified training and behavior specialist and certified in sports training, and this turns out to be a sport. Megan, here's the background to all this. It has to do with Chicago Tribune, or one time, Chicago Tribune columnist John Cass. I was supporting the notion, and I still do, of cats that are outdoor community cats. They're outdoors anyway. They're spayed and they're neutered. They go ahead and they are reintroduced into a space where there are city rats. And it turns out when the cats come in, the rats go away. And some of the rats go away the hard way. Others scamper and find new real estate, you know. And I've been, but John Cass, famous Chicago Tribune columnist at that time, not at all a supporter. What he wanted were dogs to come in and to do this. Terriers in particular, such as rat terriers, that were bred to catch rats. It turns out in New York City, in Central Park and other places, there are groups that go out with dogs that actually do this. And there turns out to be a long time dog sport that the dogs are taught to catch rats, and they don't do harm to the rats, and we'll talk about that. So what is the rat catching, I hope I can use that terminology, sport that you are teaching others to do and have a sort of city sniffer club doing it?
Right. Yeah, thanks, Steve, for your interest in chatting more about this. So I think where I would clarify is that I wouldn't use the word catch for the sporting version of this activity. Yeah, so that's we really refer to it as the rat hunt sport. And, of course, they are searching with their nose, hunting for the rats. But the rats are always protected inside of these special aerated PVC tubes, so they can never get out. They can never be harmed. But yes, the dogs are learning to find them and locate them on various courses made of different materials. It is certainly comes from the historical use of, especially like you said, terriers and dachshunds, and some of those what we call the go-to-ground breeds were used on farms originally to eradicate the vermin. But they had to go into chasing the rats into underground their burrows, their lairs. And so they had to be a certain small size to fit into these underground tunnels. Nowadays, the rat hunt sports have really evolved, and there's grown to be, you know, four or five different organizations hosting them in order to be accessible to all dogs, all different breeds, all different ages and capacities. So it's really become a very inclusive and popular sport.
So a very large dog can do this because there aren't those very small tunnels?
So they don't have to go through the small tunnels, but I have absolutely had everything from Chihuahuas to Great Danes.
All right. So
to my classes.
So describe, because, you know, it's radio, so we can't see a video of this. So describe what happens. You show up with your dog, and then what happens from there, whether your dog is quote unquote trained to do this because your dog has done it before, or you're a newbie.
Right. So let's take the barn hunt version, for example. That's what's been more commonly known in the Midwest. So we create a maze of anywhere from 25 to 75 or so straw bales. We have designs of how we set up these bales, and they do include a tunnel within them where there's the straw bales have boards on top and they're stabilized so that the dogs can go through a tunnel. However, those tunnels are at least 18 inches wide and 18 inches tall. So that's where we get to more accessibility for the larger dogs. Now, do some of the larger dogs have to crouch a little bit or even crawl? Absolutely. But it's something that they train to do and end up many of them really enjoying it. It becomes part of the fun and the game.
Well,
and similarly, in the urban version of the sport, we have tunnels that are larger as well.
So I imagine if you show up and your dog doesn't want to do this, then you go home. I mean, you can't force.
Right.
You know. So you can encourage, but that's about all I suspect you can do. So now, are there real rats that are used in this?
Absolutely, yes. We can only play the sport with live rats. However, these are not your typical, you know, alley rats we think of in Chicago. Very, very far from it. We actually use, they're called fancy rats, which is what, there's a very robust community of folks who keep rats as pets. They're very, very smart and affectionate pets. And so evolving from those communities of rat breeders, there's now many of us who teach and host the rat hunt sports who breed amongst ourselves to, you know, for certain qualities that we like to see, the confidence, the size to fit in the, into the tubes comfortably. We look for those kinds of qualities, and we now breed amongst each other so that we have a crew of rats at all times that can help us to play this sport. Now, they are, like we said, never harmed. They actually live a quite luxurious life with, you know, all sorts of fun things in their cages. They get all sorts of treats before and after working. And they really learn to become, many of them actually will interact with the dogs. I could send you videos of my puppy sitting here having a conversation with Mr. Chandler.
Mr. Chandler. I assume Mr. Chandler is one of those fancy rats. You know, rats, yeah. I want to pause for a minute to talk about rats, because rats are actually underrated pets. When people ask me about, I'd like an appropriate pocket pet or small pet. Mm-hmm. You know, guinea pigs would be second on my list. Many of the other choices are actually not as interactive or fearful of people. So to me, number one is a pet rat, and they're brilliant. It's like having a cocker spaniel, except they only live a year or two, which is to me the worst part, because they bond with you just like a dog would. Okay. What do you think?
Yeah, they do tend to only live a couple years, although I've certainly had some boys who've been over 2.5. The girl rats do tend to get different types of reproductive tumors more prominently when they're a little bit younger, so that could be a consideration. You also have to know, if you're going to keep rats, that you have to have at least two. They cannot be alone. They need to be at least in pairs. And then, of course, if you don't want to have 17 babies, you need to make sure that your pair is of the same sex. And we hear many, many stories of people who come home with rats and don't realize and suddenly end up with 30. hasn't happened to me, but I've heard many, many a story.
All right. But I want to talk.
They really are very sweet and cuddly when you get to know them.
Indeed. And I want to talk more about that. I want to talk more about these hunts that you do. It says come hunt with us on the website, so I don't know what to say. City Sniffers Dog Sports and Training. City being, in this case, either Springfield, Illinois, or Evanston right here. How can you do this? How can you sign up? And what do you do? We're going to learn all of that when we come back on WGN. Megan Renner is a certified dog trainer, a specialist in behavior and also sports training, and who knew this was a sport? What's the name of the sport, Megan? Because I'm getting it wrong, I think.
So the generic term I would use is just the rat hunt sports, but like I said, there's different venues. So barn hunt is the one that's most commonly known, and then urban ratting is a more general version for the type that is not done on the straw bale courses.
And what do you do in Evanston?
So up in Evanston, we, every Wednesday night at Rex's Place, have an urban ratting class. We do typically use the Happy Ratters venue, so happyratters.com, if you'd like to learn more about them. That's the main mode that we teach there, where we build a course made up of just, they say, stuff you might find in an urban alley, but really some of my students call it clean trash. Boxes, bags, old suitcases. We have different children's tents or cat toy things that they can climb in and around, anything that we can hide a rat tube in, we will use it. And so we will learn how first to build value for the rat. If some dogs will come in and immediately have prey drive for the rat, and some maybe aren't quite as intrinsically interested, but that's okay. They will often learn to play the game just for the pure joy of searching. Dogs love to search for all sorts of things, or possibly for the pay or the food or the treats that they might get from their handler. So it's really a team sport. Both the dog has to learn skills and the handler, including that the handler has to learn to read their dog's body language so that they can become confident of when they need to call the alert that the dog has found the rat. But again, then the rats are safely removed. They aren't never harmed or truly caught by the dog.
And John Cass should be listening to this to make a point. This is just a sport. The rats do survive. But I do wonder. I really do. And for those who just joined us, you explained a little bit earlier, a little about this. But all right, pet rats are wonderful. They're wonderful pets. They're spoiled, you say, a lot of them. And that's great. You know, they're loved. But then they see this thing that might eat them. It would be like you being, I don't know, in a maze or something, and a tiger is on the other side of it, and you're not thinking, oh, well, this is a fun day. So how do the rats, at what point do they learn, or don't they, that I'm really not terrified by this?
That they're safe. Yeah, yeah. No, it's a very good question. So we don't just go and, you know, go to the pet store and buy some rats and throw them immediately into the tube. Like that would be certainly very stressful for a brand new rat. What we tend to do in the community is, first of all, acclimate them to the tubes just by putting the tube, an empty tube, into their cage when they're young, when they're adolescent. They begin to learn to go in and out of it. Maybe they'll get food or treats in the tube, so that they become comfortable being in there and see, just the same way that we crate train dogs. We want the dog to learn to see that as a refuge and a safe place to be. And then certainly with my rats, I progress gradually to first introducing them to my dogs, who are small and not very aggressive hunters, beginning to get them acclimated to being around the dogs and progress from there. Truly, though, you know, the rats, you will often find that they're up at the front of the cage saying, take me, pick me, pick me, when we're going to load the tubes, because they've learned that it's safe and they've learned that they get good things. My guys especially like Fruit Loops when they work. I know there's much controversy about Fruit Loops nowadays, but the rats really, really do enjoy them as a little treat. So,
well, now I'm asking another question completely. What controversy is there about Fruit Loops? I had no idea.
Isn't there something about the coloring and the artificial? I saw a recent TikTok video about how it's banned in Europe.
Really? I don't doubt it. But then again, I'm not one for believing every TikTok video there is. All right. So in Evanston, where is this done?
So we train in Evanston at Rex's Place. Which is a fabulous daycare facility that also has a huge sports arena on one side of it. For those who are interested in dog agility, it's a great place to go play. We also are getting ready to host our first workshop within the city limits next month, and that's going to be at Urban Pooch.
Oh, sure.
At the training center on Damon Avenue. So that's, I believe that the working spots are already booked for the three sessions, but there is space to audit that workshop for folks who are interested. That would just mean that the handler, the human, comes without the dog and can still learn about the sport and observe.
And where can one learn more about this? I suspect you have a website that says everything.
I do, yes. So if you go to www.citysnippers, plural, .org, you will find information there about both all different explanations of the sports. There's video demonstrations, as well as information about the Evanston training and my facility down in Springfield, where we do both the barn hunt and the urban versions of the sport.
And these rat classes, how many weeks is it consecutively, and about how much do they cost?
So we actually use a model where our students buy a package. So you can buy packages of three or six classes, or you can also just buy a single if you want to come and try it out one time and make sure that your dog likes it. And then they can just apply those credits across the different dates on the schedule. So you don't have to commit to a 6 week. I know when I was particularly training my dogs and working full time in my previous job, it was very hard sometimes to commit to a full 6 weeks. So I really do like the package method. And then the single classes are $35 at Evanston, and then it is a little bit of a discount when you buy the 3 or 6 class packages.
Have you ever had a dog that shows up and is so hyper excited, overstimulated, that, okay, this isn't right? Or the reverse, a dog that just looks up in the air and says, you know, I don't care.
Probably yes to both. Although I would say, you know, on the lower interest end of the spectrum, oftentimes that kind of a reaction is born from anxiety. Maybe this is the first time that the dog has been out to a place or around other dogs, or you know, maybe it's a brand new foster dog. So sometimes that's just a matter of socializing the dog and helping them get used to being in the space and around the other people and dogs. I have seen ratting as well as other scent sports do wonders for some of the foster and rescue dogs that come in and really need to gain confidence. Sniffing is an intrinsic behavior that dogs do when they're stressed. So if you give them a sport where they can sniff all the time, it can really be a win-win. On the flip side, certainly there are dogs that are very highly aroused by hunting for rats. Often these dogs are very high energy in all other phases of life. And so they tend to have to work on different skills in order to be able to navigate life safely.
Sure.
But certainly I've had both extremes, but more often they land somewhere in the middle, and we just figure out what's the dog's primary motivation to play the sport, and then we build the training plan around that.
Megan Renner, oh rats, I'm out of time. Thank you so very much. I know you've been waiting for this, the most popular dog names, at least according to Pupford.com. I'll go through them fairly quickly, starting at number 20, it's Rocky. Number 19, Molly. 18 is Bear. Coda is 17. Continuing to count down, it's Sadie, Buddy, Teddy, Nala, Loki. I've not met a Loki dog, but that's the 12th most popular. Number 11 is Willow. At number 10, Coco, inspired by the movie, I believe. Number 9 is Lucy. Number 8, Cooper. 7 is Bailey. At number 6, it's Max. Now, this is a big deal because Max has taken a great fall. Max was number 1. Number 5 is Daisy. Number 4 is Chuck or Charlie. Number 3 is Milo. Number 2 is Bella. And the most popular dog name is Luna. She is president at Anti-Cruelty. Darlene Duggan is here. Darlene, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I've known you for so many years going back. You've been around the animal welfare world in Chicago for a very long time. I want to talk about the animal welfare world in Chicago. I want to talk about the coalition of animal shelters that I know Anti-Cruelty is very involved in. But one thing that should be at the top of the list that's most important, and I don't know if Anti-Cruelty has taken an official position on this controversial issue. I am talking about cookies. Not cookies for dogs. I am talking about the cookies either with my face on it or with, what's his name, Paul Lisnick, his face from WGN television on it. So the person who sells the least number of cookies, which will be Paul, by April Fools will be named by Windy City Sweets, where those cookies are sold, as Chicago's greatest fool. But meanwhile, proceeds from every cookie sold do go to Anti-Cruelty. Now, here you are in this very unique position. And I know Anti-Cruelty typically does not get involved in political issues. However, I will ask you, whose cookie you most support?
Steve, you're coming right out of the gate with one of the hardest questions I've ever had to answer in my career. How are you going to make me choose? This is like somebody saying, which is your favorite child, or dogs or cats, who do you like better? It's an impossible question to answer. My answer is going to be, I like the cookie that can generate the most revenue for Anti-Cruelty.
Oh, well, that would clearly be my cookie. because my cookies will clearly sell far more. Now, Windy City Sweets is located on Broadway, just north, about a block north of Belmont, on the west side of the street. And this all really began as an ice cream contest first, in the pandemic. And it was a way to support a small business as well as support anti-cruelty at a time when non-for-profits like yours weren't really getting attention and small businesses were having a hard time. One can argue in Chicago right now, small businesses continue for other reasons to have a hard time. So we, no matter what, Paul and I, we never agree on very much. But what we do agree on is the political issue that anti-cruelty should be supported and you should buy all the cookies you possibly can buy. You know, I mentioned the pandemic, and here's what happened, Darlene, during the pandemic in Chicago, all over the country, that there was a call out for adoptions and people adopted dogs and cats and other animals left and right. The shelters were cleared. I believe that was the case at anti-cruelty that Chicago's stepped up and, if not adopted, fostered. Am I right about that?
Yes, you're absolutely right. During that pandemic, it was imperative for us to clear as many animals out of the shelter as we possibly could for a variety of reasons, but mostly, actually, to be honest with you, for the safety of our staff, during the early phases of the pandemic, when we didn't know exactly yet how to keep ourselves safe and how to keep each other safe, and certainly before we had vaccines or even masking mandates, it was just unsafe for us to have that many people in the building. And, you know, when you have 500 plus animals on site, you need a lot of people to care for those animals. So the most suitable solution at that point in time was to either adopt as many of those animals as we possibly could and get them into their permanent homes, or request foster placement for them so that at least temporarily they were out of the building and in the direct care of someone that could care for them long term. So Chicago stepped up in more ways than one for us during those pandemic months and years even, and really did a great service to our organization and to the members of our population. So it was a really beautiful and challenging time in our history.
Now, what I understand, though, is that today, fast forward the clock to right now, not many more pets are being relinquished to shelters, despite what the popular press may say one way or the other. However, not as many are being fostered and not as many are being adopted. Is that true with you?
Yes, that is true. So in animal welfare, we talk about intake and outcomes. So intake is how those animals find their way to our shelter or find their way to needing our services. And for the most part, the intake, the volume of intake that we're seeing right now at anti-cruelty is similar to what it was pre-pandemic. So historically, nothing has significantly changed with our statistics or our data in that regard. The big change or the big difference that we're seeing is on the outcome side. We just don't have as many adoptions moving out of the shelter. Specifically for large dogs, cats actually are okay. Cat levels have rebounded from, you know, back to pre-pandemic adoption rates and adoption levels. So we're very, very grateful and appreciative for that. But it's large dogs that we're still challenged with right now.
Why do you think that is, Darlene?
Oh, Steve, there's so many reasons. And, you know, we're still scratching our heads here at Anti-Cruelty. Animal welfare shelters across the country are still kind of scratching their heads. We're pouring through data, we're talking to experts, and nobody really can point one reason. Certainly there's an economic impact to that. It costs more for you and I to buy our weekly groceries, it costs more to care for a pet, and a dog is bigger and has more needs than a cat does, and a large dog is bigger and has more needs than a small dog does. So I think that plays a factor. Similarly, there is a veterinary shortage, there continues to be a veterinary shortage, again, nationwide, which affects our ability to be able to care for our pets' medical needs. So it you know, is driving up the cost at our veterinary clinics as well. And there's a lot more going back to the workplace. So the remote work or the work from home seems to be on the decline right now. So I think a lot of people are just reluctant to bring either a new member of the family into the household or to add an additional member of the family into the household, knowing that perhaps they're not going to be around or as available as they were a couple of years ago to kind of socialize and hang out with that animal. And there's probably a variety of other reasons too, but we're continuing to keep our finger on that pulse, and we're doing everything that we can to reverse that trend, but we're still not there yet.
Well, I want to talk about those other reasons, or at least some of them, I will throw at you, and we will do that and also talk about an exciting announcement that you guys are about to make. You are going to compete with me on the radio, it turns out. Well, not really, but we'll talk about that when we come back on WGN. Darlene Duggan is the president of Anti-Cruelty Society. Oh, by the way, I'm Steve Dale, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. Darlene, we're talking about when we hit the break as to why, or at least some of the reasons why, large dogs in particular are not being adopted. Cats, you said, are doing okay, at least holding their own. Small dogs, almost there to where the cats are, but not the big guys. And here are some other things that I think are a part of this. There are more multi-pet homes than ever before because of all the adoptions that occurred during the pandemic. Housing, I think, is another reason because, after all, increasingly apartments and condos are saying, oh, you can have a dog. Actually, increasingly, they're saying you cannot have a dog. And then they're saying if you do have a dog, that dog has to be, you name it, 20, 25 pounds, whatever the weight limit is. But under that weight limit, which the big dogs, well, they're big dogs. So they're out. Do you think that these are factors as well?
Absolutely, Steve. I think you hit the nail on the head. Those are definitely factors, and we see them and hear about them all of the time at the shelter. And in fact, you know, earlier I was talking about our intake numbers, and we do offer counseling for folks that need to relinquish or are thinking about relinquishing their pets. And so often we hear people telling us stories about just not being able to find pet-friendly housing. So that is certainly a contributing factor to what we're seeing right now in our adoption rates.
And people are listening to this thinking, oh, well, what are they talking about? Because I live down the street or maybe live in a high rise where not only are all pets welcome, but there's amenities for pets. But I will tell you, not all neighborhoods appear to be that way. And not all cities, looking at this nationwide, are that way at all, Darlene.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think that there is a shift maybe in desirability of some larger dogs. We're seeing more and more people being able to rehome their pets without involving the shelter, which on the front side of that seems like a very good thing. If the animal can avoid coming to the shelter, that should be celebrated, and that should be a positive for that animal, and it definitely is. But the animals, the dogs in particular, that we are seeing come into the shelter have more and more behavior concerns. Either they are resource guarders, or they don't get along with other animals, or they are shy and fearful or scared or timid. And that often is the reason why people are relinquishing those animals. And again, probably unsuccessful in being able to rehome their animal themselves. Thus, the shelter tends to be their last resort. So partially, I think it has to do with population. A lot of our animals just have some things that they have to work through, in which, you know, that's where we rely so heavily on foster homes and volunteers and certainly our staff and supporters to help us, work with those animals while they're in our care so that we can get them into the right home and get them ready for a home.
You know, depending, I'm so glad you brought this up. So depending on the survey you look at, arguably the most or among the most significant explanations for relinquishing a pet has to do with behavior, either a behavior that's very difficult to live with for that individual family. Interestingly enough, another family would say that's not a behavior problem for us. So that that's one thing. But the other might be having to do with behavior as well, a behavior issue that is quite significant. And they give up the pet, and they may not even explain to the shelter as to why they're relinquishing that pet. This is not new. And I applaud anti-cruelty. For one thing, you have a behavior hotline that you can talk about. That's one thing. And then the other is that once you adopt, that help is always available. You even offer dog training classes there. And the behavior helpline isn't only for dogs, it's for cats as well. So I'll let you talk about those things.
Yeah, the behavior hotline is actually not only for dogs or cats or for any animal for that matter. It doesn't even limit itself to the Chicagoland area. We get calls and we get support requests from around the country. So the behavior hotline is something that folks can call into, email us, and say, hey, this is where my pet is struggling. What would you recommend? And one of our certified behaviorists, in-house certified behaviorists, will walk you through some options and counsel and kind of hold your hand through all of those pieces while you kind of explore options for how to help your pet and how to keep your pet in the home that it has already. That is, Steve, ultimately our end goal is, you know, we don't want these animals to come to the shelter. We want them to stay in the homes. And especially when people reach out to us for help, you know, we're halfway there. They're already asking for assistance, and we're ready to be able to help them in that capacity.
Do you happen to know the phone number?
You know, that's the second hardest question you've asked me today.
Okay,
You
can call this
if
number.
If you go on our website,
yes. Okay.
You will see that phone number and the email address that you can use to reach the behavior hotline.
Or I believe the phone number for the shelter is 312-644-8338.
Correct. That's our main line, and we can certainly get you to the right place if you call the main number.
All right, we have 1 minute left for you to make an exciting announcement.
Yes, so Anti-Cruelty is so excited to announce that we will soon be launching our very own podcast.
Yay!
Called Sit, Stay, Listen, the Anti-Cruelty Podcast, and it is going to cover so many exciting topics, all having to do with the human-animal bond. And when I say human-animal bond, I certainly mean companion animals, dogs, cats, rabbits, guinea pigs, all of our favorite babies that we share our homes with, but also other animals, maybe that we don't necessarily share our homes with, but that we do share our environment or our community with, wildlife and zoo animals. We're planning to talk to researchers who are doing such interesting research that impacts that human-animal bond. We're going to be talking to, like I said, zoo specialists and museum curators and so many exciting, interesting people, and perhaps even Chicago's very own Steve Dale.
Well, you can hear all about it, as I will talk about it, when you are ready to say more as to where people can listen. But I assume wherever podcasts can be heard, and you could also check out anticruelty.org to learn, yes, about the behavior helpline, or as you said, the hotline. I like that better. Or many of the other services. If you have a problem right now with your pet, and not only a behavior issue, but for example, there's domestic violence going on. Anti-cruelty is there to help. Anticruelty.org. Darlene Duggan, thank you so much. So how did it happen that wolves, a wolf species 30 to 40,000 years ago that no longer even exists today, transformed magically over a period of time, quickly by evolutionary standards, into today's dogs, from toy poodles to collies and everything else, dogs being the most varied species ever on the planet? How did that happen? And there are a couple of theories, and one of those theories, a team of mathematicians and statisticians from various universities using, what did they use? Simulations and artificial intelligence figured, well, one of those theories is probably true, that dogs essentially domesticated themselves. Leave it to dogs. Lots more about this on my website. That's stevedale.tv. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, right here on WGN.